drama team that helped communicate a little bit about what we're trying to look at. If you have your Bibles with you, turn to the book of Habakkuk in the Old Testament, one of the prophets that has a shorter prophecy, a shorter writing. And as we continue our study through Habakkuk, we're coming to the place in this first chapter of Habakkuk. And the title of this message is When God Doesn't Make Sense. When God Doesn't Make Sense. Sometimes things happen in life, just like we had portrayed out here, that you just go sometimes, God, this doesn't make sense. What are you doing? What's going on? And Habakkuk is at that point in his life right now, in his conversation with God, where I believe what Habakkuk is saying is, God, you don't make sense. This does not make sense. Habakkuk has first come to God in the first four verses of chapter 1, and he asked God, how long and why? How long do we have to continue to see violence in the streets of Jerusalem and in Judea? How long are your people going to continue to behave badly and you not do anything? And God, why am I the one who has to keep watching all of this and seeing it and be burdened with the righteousness of my God and the unrighteousness of my people? Why is that? God answers him in verses 5 through 11 with a remarkable answer, one that doesn't seem to make sense either. This is why he comes to the place where he says, God, you don't make sense with this. God gives him an unbelievable solution. And he says, I'm doing a work in your day, and if you were told about it, it wouldn't even make sense to you. You wouldn't believe it anyway. And then he tells him what the work was and it is. In verse 6, he says, for behold, I am raising up the Chaldeans. And then he tells him what he's going to do with them. They're coming through the land. They're marching through. You can't stop them. They're like a bunch of leopards. They're like a bunch of raving wolves. Their horses are faster than any other horses. They move in like a swarm of bees and just take over and devour and move on. And that's what's going to happen to Judea. Now, probably Habakkuk sat on that answer for a little while and thought about it and shook his head and listened to things rattle around up there. And then he came back with another answer that seems to be saying, but God, that doesn't really make sense. And this is where we go today. And if you would, stand with me in the honor of reading God's Word as we look at Habakkuk chapter 1, verses 12 through 17, and then verse 1 of chapter 2. If you don't have a Bible with you, that passage of Scripture is on the back of the bulletin you have there, if you got one when you came in the door. Habakkuk goes back to God after God's answer, and he asks him, he says, art thou not from everlasting, O Lord, my God, my Holy One? We will not die. Thou, O Lord, hast appointed them to judge, and thou, O rock, hast established them to correct. Your eyes are too pure to approve evil, and you cannot look on wickedness with favor. Why do you look with favor on those who deal treacherously? Why are you silent when the wicked swallow up those more righteous than they? Why have you made men like fish of the sea, like creeping things without a ruler over them? The Chaldeans bring all of them up with a hook, drag them away with their net, and gather them together in their fishing net. Therefore they rejoice and are glad. Therefore they offer sacrifice to their net and burn incense to their fishing net, because through these things their catch is large and their food is plentiful. Will they therefore empty their net and continually slay nations without sparing? Habakkuk's stance is, I will stand on my guard post and station myself on the rampart, and I will keep watch to see what he will speak to me and how I may reply when I am reproved. You may be seated. Habakkuk seems to be saying, if this is the case, God, it doesn't really make sense that you would send the Chaldeans to judge the Israelites, your people. It's almost like Habakkuk was going back to God and saying, "Now, God, I know I complained to you about how bad it is down here, how violent these people are, how terrible it is that I have to sit here and look at all this all the time and wondering what you're going to do, but my goodness, you're not going to send those uncouth, barbarian Chaldeans in here to persecute us, are you? I mean, this is a little ridiculous. It's kind of a overkill, isn't it, God? It's kind of like going rabbit hunting with a deer rifle. You know, you're just going overboard here. It just doesn't seem to make sense." Well, I believe as we look at things like this in our life and in life in general, there are some things that we can learn from Habakkuk's conversation with God and understand a little bit about where we are in our own individual's life. I think there's three things that we can see real quickly in this passage of Scripture about Habakkuk when he comes to God and he daringly questions God about something. He daringly questions God. Now, he does not pull any punches with God. He doesn't withhold anything from him. He daringly comes to God, and he first came in daringness to complain to God, and God answered him. I mean, that should have been sufficient. But he daringly comes back the second time and complains further and says, "Now, wait a minute, God. You've got to explain this to me now. I still have a question, why?" You see, he asked how long and why in the first complaint. And God answered him how long. He said, "I'm doing a work in your day. I'm raising up the Chaldeans. How long? It'll happen before you die. It's going to happen. It's in your day." But he didn't answer him why. So he comes back and he says, "Why is it going to be this way?" I think there's three things we can see real quickly about expressions that God, when we go to God. One is the expression of confidence. The expression of confidence. Habakkuk approaches the throne of God and he says with a rhetorical question, "Art thou not from everlasting, O Lord my God, my Holy One?" Now, a rhetorical question is a question that is asked that already has the apparent answer. It is an apparent answer that it was an affirmative answer. And what the rhetorical question does is it asks whoever the question is given to get involved with the conversation. And so what Habakkuk says when he talks to God is he says, "God, aren't you everlasting?" With an obvious answer, "Yes, I know this is true. I know this is real. I know this is a reality in my life. Get involved here. Get involved in it. Show me something. Teach me something. Let me see something." But he gives some expressions of confidence in saying this, and I believe there are six things in verse 12 that we can learn about confidence that God. It's convictions that give us confidence, and confidence that calms the soul of a person who is tormented with the question, why? Convictions that give us confidence. Many people were looking for confidence to soothe the soul. But what it takes is convictions that bring about the confidence. And I believe that's what Habakkuk teaches us. Number one, he teaches us here that the confidence that he has is in a God of eternity. A God of eternity. Ask him, "Aren't you foreverlasting? Aren't you eternal?" That is, aren't you transcendent? Aren't you self-sufficient apart from this world? You don't have to have this world to be God. You're above this world. You're beyond this world. You oversee everything that's in this world. And you're unchanging in that. This world can cease to exist and God will still be God. People can cease to worship him and God will still be God. God doesn't need anything to be God. He is God. That's all he needs. That's all he is. And what Habakkuk comes to him with this conviction that says, "I know you're from everlasting. I know you're eternal. I know that's the reality of who you are. I know who you are. I know you're self-sufficient." And he also says, "Aren't you everlasting, O Lord?" The word "O Lord," the word for Lord there, is the word Yahweh, sometimes pronounced Jehovah. Yahweh is a breath word of Hebrew language. It is something that is breathed out. It's not the articulation of something to be screamed. It's to be breathed out. It's Yahweh. It's the breath out. And it's a humbling thing for the human being to pronounce Yahweh. The Jews still will not pronounce the name Yahweh because there's holy and reverence about it. And there's some concern about even how to pronounce it completely. But it It is the word that God gave to himself. It's the name that God gave to himself when Moses said at the burning bush, "Who do I say sent me?" He said, "You tell him Yahweh sent you. You tell him I am that I am sent you." The best interpretation we have it is somewhat of the verb to be, "I am sent you." That is, he is imminent. He is present. He is the ever-present presence in our midst. He is imminent in the creation of the world. He's active in it, and he's involved in it. And he's present even now. So what Habakkuk is saying, not only do I know that you're everlasting, that you're transcendent, that you're way out there, that you're beyond all of this, that you don't need any of this, but I also know that you are Yahweh. You're present. You're here. You're involved in this creation of yours. But also the word Yahweh comes with it with an understanding of covenant relationship. That is that Habakkuk was proclaiming that he had confidence in the reality that Jesus, or that God made the Israelite nation a covenant. And Yahweh is, I am that I am. It is the ever-present reality of that covenant. And he's saying to God, I know not only that you're everlasting, but I also know that you don't break your covenant with your people. And so though I may not understand what's going on, and though I may be questioning why, I'm not questioning who you are, and I'm not questioning your method of doing things. In fact, he calls him my God. That's another thing that he teaches us about this confidence. The word God is the Hebrew word Elohim. It is the word for supreme or divine. It is the word that is used for creator. In the beginning, Elohim, God, created heaven and earth. He is the creator. He is the judge. And what he is saying is, I know this is who you are. And not only that, I personalize it. I say, my God. Now, I believe what Habakkuk is saying there is somewhat what Jacob said when he wrestled with the angel of the Lord, and he said, I will not let you go till you bless me. I believe Habakkuk was saying, you're my God, and I'm not giving up on this. You and I are having a conversation here. I've asked you, you've answered, I'm asking again, I expect another answer. You're my God, I'm not giving up on this. You are mine, and I'm yours, and that's our identity is all wrapped up together. My identity is wrapped up in who you are. You're my God. Then he says, you're not only my God, but you're my Holy One. That is, that you are separate from all the events in life. You know what we do that's wrong, I believe, in America today a lot of times? Is we take an event in life and we expect it to define God. Or we think it may define God. I read a little story about that I want to just tell you about. It's in Philip Yancey's book called Church, Why Bother? Which is a very good little book, and it's very has some great stories in it and real life things and great application about why people need to be involved in community life of the church. But he tells this story about a man named Douglas. And he interviewed Douglas, Philip Yancey interviewed Douglas in the writing of his book, Disappointment with God. And as he talks about Douglas, he says that he lived the most Job-like existence. Now, I kind of identify with that, seemed like, lately, because I started telling people last week just to call me Job Jr. Because, you know, if anything else can go wrong, I'm not sure what's going to go wrong. But I'm sure there are other things that can go wrong. But I just felt like Job Jr. He tells about Douglas. He says, just when he made a sacrificial decision to enter urban ministry, his world unraveled. Funding for his ministry fell through, his wife got cancer, and a drunk driver hit his car, badly injuring Douglas and his 12-year-old daughter. Not long afterward, his wife died. I wanted Douglas to describe his disappointment with God, but to my surprise, he reported that he had not had such feelings. I learned long ago, and especially through these tragedies, Douglas told me, not to confuse God with life. I'm no stoic. I am upset about what happened to me as anyone could be. I feel free to curse the unfairness of life and to vent all my grief and anger. But I believe God feels the same way as I do about the accident, grieved and angry. I don't blame him for what has happened. And then he continued, I have learned to see beyond the physical reality in this world to the spiritual reality. We tend to think life should be fair because God is fair. But God is not life. If we develop a relationship with God apart from our life circumstances, Then we may be able to hang on when the physical reality breaks down. We can learn to trust God despite all the unfairness of life. Isn't that true? I believe that's what Habakkuk is teaching us when he calls him my Holy One. That he is separate from all the events of life. And if we can hold on to God away from these events of life, then we can hold on to him and survive through anything. And I believe that's what Habakkuk is saying. God, as he says, as he comes to the next phrase, he says, you've appointed them to judge, and he says, you've established them to correct. He's saying, I'll accept the Chaldeans coming. It doesn't make sense to me. It doesn't seem to be what is even reasonable or rational that you would send somebody so unrighteous to judge and correct your righteous people, but I'll accept that reality because you're Holy One. You're beyond all of this, and I'll hold on to who you are. And then he calls him, he says that we will not die. Now, that's an interesting phrase because it's just kind of thrown in there. I mean, you'll have to admit that it really doesn't seem to fit with the whole framework of God, aren't you everlasting? And okay, Lord, you've appointed them to judge and you've appointed them to correct. We will not die is thrown in between there. It's like the meat in between the two bread, pieces of bread. It's sandwiched in there and you don't really see it. You don't really identify it. We will not die. But it's emphatic, I believe, in the Hebrew language as it's put in there in the poetic sense that he's saying, I know we're the Jews. I know we're the chosen people. I know that you have a remnant who will always come through because that's what you promised. And that's exactly what God had promised in Deuteronomy. He said, when my people turn away from me, I'll bring from the outside external forces and I will discipline them and I will correct them. But what will come out of it will always be a remnant of my people, a remnant, a group who will be faithful to me always. And what I believe Habakkuk is saying is, we're not going to die. The Chaldeans may come, and they may come like leopards, and they may come like ravenous wolves, and they may come in the forts, and they may destroy and all these things, but we're your chosen people, and we will not die. We will always exist. What confidence that conviction brings to a tormented soul, that it can calm that tormented soul down. He also says, you are faithful, God. You're faithful. I know you're faithful. I've read of your faithfulness. I've heard of your faithfulness. I've spoke of your faithfulness. I am experiencing your faithfulness, and I am convinced that you will be faithful. You will fulfill whatever covenant it is you have established with your people. And then he gives him one other title in there. He says, O Rock. Rock. Rock in the Old Testament gives that title to God as a source of security and stability. It is found in Psalms chapter 31 when the psalmist writes, as David writes, In thee, O Lord, I have taken refuge. Let me never be ashamed. In thy righteousness, deliver me. Incline thine ear to me. Rescue me quickly. Be thou to me a rock of strength, a stronghold to save me. For thou art my rock and my fortress. For thy name's sake, thou wilt lead me and guide me. Thou wilt pull me out of the net which they have secretly laid for me. For thou art my strength. Into thy hand I commit my spirit. For thou hast ransomed me, O Lord God of truth. The Habakkuk, being familiar with the priesthood, being a priest in the temple, he knew these realities of God. He knew what David had prayed. He knew Moses had said that he is the rock of my salvation. So when he said, this is my rock, I know my rock is solid, secure, stable. Confidence expressed because it brings about a calmness of the soul. Tell you what, whenever things happen in life and you have the confidence of Habakkuk, you have the confidence to come before your God and you have the confidence to say before him, I know you are imminent in my existence here. I know you're transcendent over me. I know that you are so real that your covenant is always being abided to. You're my God. You're my Holy One. My identity is wrapped up in you. It's not wrapped up in the violence of my streets. It's not wrapped up in the corruptness of my people. It's not wrapped up in the political stances of everything that's going on around me. It's my, you are mine. And you are my rock. You are my stability. You are my strength. That's my dependence. See, Habakkuk had expressions of confidence that calmed the soul. Not only did he go from the expression of confidence, though, because once that confidence was there, that doesn't mean the confusion goes away, because the next very words out of his mouth are expressions of confusion. He says, now, your eyes, God, are too pure to approve evil. I know this is true. This is what my theology teaches me. You cannot look on wickedness with favor. I know this is true because this is what I've been taught. This is the reality of the Scriptures. But God, why does it seem to me that you're looking at favor or looking with favor on those who deal treacherously? Now, he's looking at the Chaldeans. And the Chaldeans, they don't worship God. I mean, they don't even pretend to worship God. And he's saying, why are you looking with favor on them? Why are you showing grace to them and giving them, in raising them up and giving them the force and the power to do this, to ravage the nation? And so his confusion is, wait a minute, what I know about your character, God, and what I perceive to be happening doesn't gel. It doesn't jive. What I know about your character, God, righteousness and justice, holy, and what I perceive to be happening, it doesn't work. It doesn't make sense. I mean, it seems like you're silent when the wicked are coming in and swallowing up those who are more righteous than them. That's a key phrase, because in a few weeks we're going to look at the heart of what Habakkuk talks about. The heart of what Habakkuk talks about in his whole prophecy is that a righteous man lives by faith. See, what Habakkuk is saying, I mean, it appears that we're at least more righteous than they are. At least we pretend to be worshiping God. I mean, at least we will take the scrolls and read them. At least we will proclaim the name of God. At least we'll attribute creation to Elohim. But these Chaldeans, they come in and, I mean, they make sacrifices to their net. And they worship their brutality and their violence and their unbelievable way of horrifying people. That's what they worship. You see, God's not very interested in pretending. In fact, God's not interested in pretending at all. You can pretend all you want to that you love God. You can pretend all you want to that you know God. You can use the language. You can talk the talk. You can read your Scriptures every day. You can witness and win people to Christ all the time. But if it's all a pretending to you, God's not really interested in your pretending. Not interested in it at all. But Habakkuk comes, and in this expressions of confusion, it seems to him that the cure is worse than the illness. It seems to him that God, if you're sovereign, and I know you are, then how can you continue to allow this to happen? Why do you look with favor? Why are you silent? You see, the question, God, why, is not wrong. Now, a lot of times we've been taught, you know, we're not to question why. Ours is to do or die. But the question, God, why, is not wrong. It depends on the attitude and the motive that may be determining what's wrong, but just simply the question, God, why, is not wrong. In fact, one author said, there has always been the important distinction between bitter cynicism and believing confrontation. One is a denial that refuses to believe. The other, a belief that refuses to deny. One makes assertion and will not stay around for an answer. The other makes assertion and will not move until there is an answer. You see, sometimes we question God, why? It's out of a cynical heart. We're not really wanting an answer. We're just wanting to complain. Habakkuk questioned God, why? It was not out of a cynical heart. It was out of a believing confrontation. I know you're God. I know my identity is wrapped up in you. But I'm still confused with this whole mess of stuff down here. And then he expresses some concern. Verses 14 through 17. Why hast thou made men like fish of the sea? See, he identifies that God is the maker. He is the sovereign one. Like the creeping things without a ruler over them. Now then the Chaldeans, they come in and they take them up with a hook. They drag them away with their net. They're gathering them just like they're fishing. And that's the emblems that he gives and the language that he uses. It's just like fishing. They go out and throw their nets and they scoop them all up and then they're devastated. Here are his concerns that he's saying. If things happen the way you say that they're going to happen, if the Chaldeans come in and they just throw out their nets and they scoop all of us up like fishermen and they hook us. And there's probably a great image there of the Assyrian army when they went in and took the Jews, the northern kingdom of Israel, and they took them captive. One of the practices of the Assyrian army whenever they took the men and women captive is that they would take a hook and they would hook their lips. And then they would put them together just like you would a what we'd call a trout line, kind of. And they'd just hook their lips together, and they would march them down the street and march them into the capital city. And this was their lot in life. This is what they had won. This is the humility that they had brought on the people. And the idea here is, if this is what happens, if the Chaldeans come in and this is the humiliating thing we've got to face, God, I just don't understand. At worst, we'll be annihilated. At best, we'll be scattered throughout. How are the prophecies of what you've said through Isaiah, what you're saying through Jeremiah right now, and Nahum and Habakkuk and Zephaniah, what you're saying, how are these things going to come about? Now, there may even be a hint in there about, God, what are people going to say about your character? I mean, if this is your people. I mean, have you ever felt the idea, have you ever felt like, you know, God, if this is the way you treat your friends, ooh, I don't know if I want to be an enemy at all. I thought I was a friend, God, and if this is the way you treat me, you know, what does that say to other people? And there may be a hint in what Habakkuk is saying is God, what kind of testimony is this going to be out here? Now, again, I think most of the time whenever I say, God, you know, if this is the way you treat a friend, all I'm looking for is relief. I'm not looking for an answer. I'm just looking to get out of the situation I'm in. And I say, now, God, it's your testimony I'm concerned about. Oh, give me a break. You know, it's not God's testimony. Habakkuk may truly be saying, it's your testimony I'm concerned about. But I believe down deep within, Habakkuk is saying, God, if they come in and take them, they're taking me too. What about those of us who are your prophets and who are your priests and who are your people, the remnant that's still here? What about us? Are we going to be hooked in the lip and dragged off? Are we going to be scooped up in the net just like everybody else? What about us? You see, Habakkuk had this confidence about him, but it still had a confusion and he still had concern. And then Habakkuk took his position. Habakkuk came to the end of this prayer and he said, okay, God, here's my position. I will stand on my guard post and I'll station myself on the rampart. That is, I'm going to take my station on the wall. I'm a watchman, and I'm watching, and I'm waiting. I'm going to stand there, and I'm going to take my station, and I will keep watch to see what you will speak to me and how I may reply when I am reproved. Now, I'm going to quickly give you six things about watching and waiting, what it takes to get to the place where Habakkuk is, where in the midst of our confusion of life, in the midst of the things that we see going on around us, when we can have confidence in God, but it doesn't erase the confusion and it doesn't erase the concern, there are six things I think that we can learn from Habakkuk about watching and waiting that will help us in watching and waiting. Number one, watching and waiting takes time. Now, we have grown to be a society that does not like to wait. I mean, I've changed from a telephone line internet service to a cable line internet service because I wanted it faster. I mean, it took 30 seconds to download before. I don't want it 30 seconds. I want it 2 seconds. I want it faster. We've got to where, you know, everything is needing to be hurry up in our society. When we go and stand at a checkout line at the grocery store and there's 44 cash registers and 3 cashiers, we go, what in the world? Whose idiotic economics is this? If you spend all that money, hire some people to run those stupid things. Because I don't have time. I don't want to. How many times have something happened in your life and you say, Lord, I don't have time for this? Watching and waiting takes time. Habakkuk said, God, I've got time. I'm going to stay right here. I'm not moving until you talk. I want to find out what the answer is. I'm struggling. I've got concerns. I've got confusion. It's not about who you are. It's about what's going on around here. I want to know. I'm going to take my stand. Most of us got a form of spiritual ADD when it comes to taking our time. We've got an attention deficit disorder when it comes to God. We come to God and we say, okay, God, what are we going to do? Hurry. I didn't hear you. Now. I don't have till this afternoon, God. Waiting, watching takes time. Another thing it takes is it calls for quietness. This one really is a sore spot for me because I like to talk. Quietness makes us nervous. We like busy work in our society. See how nervous you're getting? Just a little bit of quietness. Just a few seconds. And we all start smiling. We all start thinking, what's going on? What's he up to? See, that's exactly what it takes with God. When there's a midst of confusion, there's a midst of concern, it takes a moment. It takes time. It takes quietness. We like busy work. We like talking. God says, be still and know that I'm God. Not only does it take time and quietness, but it takes aloneness. When you're in the midst of confusion and when you're in the midst of concern, if you're like I am, and maybe you're not because everybody's personality is a little bit different, the one thing I don't like to be is alone. It's depressing. I don't like going home to an empty house. Especially if I'm unhappy. Now, sometimes I'm peopled out sometimes. I mean, I've told you that before. There's times Stella just parties and parties and parties, and I'll finally look at her and say, honey, I'm peopled out. I just got to stay home by myself, you know, absorbed into that computer, you know. Nobody else to talk with, just me. I like that sometimes. But, boy, when you're in the position of Habakkuk and you're in hurt and you're in pain and you're looking and you're going, God, I don't understand what's going on around me, what you're really saying, it takes aloneness sometimes, and that's not what I like. I like being with people sometimes when I'm that way. I want somebody else to carry my burden for me. You know what? This was the oracle which Habakkuk the prophet saw. This was the burden which God gave him to bear. Now, it's true in the church life and spiritual life, we are to bear one another's burdens, but we also must bear the burden that is ours to bear. Sometimes it takes aloneness. It's not fun. It's not fun. Another thing it takes is it takes turning it over to God. And that's not easy either. Turning it over to God. Because we want to figure it out. Because we want to fix it. And watching and waiting says, okay, God, I can't figure it out. That's what Habakkuk is saying. This does not make sense to me. I may accept it. You may be judging. You may be correcting. But it does not make sense to me. I can't figure it out. I can't fix it. So I'll take my stand, and I'll station myself, and I'll keep watch. I'll turn it over to you. Got things like that going on in your life?
I do.
Got some things that happened this week like that in my life. I can't figure it out. Can't fix it. Just got to turn it over to God. That's not what I want to do. I want to figure it out. I want to fix it. I want an answer. Another thing that it takes is perseverance. It takes waiting. It takes waiting. I believe Habakkuk would have stayed in that station. He would have stood. He would have kept watch until he died. It takes perseverance. When we don't have an answer from God, sometimes it's too easy for us just to overlook it and go on. And down deep inside, we're still mad at God. We're still blaming Him for something. Instead of taking that position and saying, God, I'll persevere. I'll persevere until You give me an answer, until I understand, until there's some conclusion I can figure out in some way that You've spoken to me. And I think the last thing that it takes, watching and waiting, and maybe one of the hardest, is watching and waiting implies being open to correction. You see, Habakkuk says, I'll take my stand, I'll take my station, and I'll watch and I'll wait. And I'll try to figure out how I'm going to reply when I'm reproved. Habakkuk said, I know I'm going to get corrected. Because I know God's not wrong. If there's a misunderstanding in this whole deal, it's not God. He's not misunderstood. He's not misunderstanding anything. He knows if anybody's misunderstanding, it's me. And I have the confidence enough to come to God and bring these accusations and bring these complaints to Him because I know who He is. I know my relationship with Him. But I also know that if there's any misunderstanding, I'm the one that's going to be corrected. And watching and waiting means I'll be implied to that correction. Honesty only is truly associated with humility. Because if it's not associated with humility, all it is complaining. It's not honest. Sometimes we don't want to listen to God because we know if we listen, our lives are going to have to change. If He answers, my life won't be the same. And our sin nature rebels against that. So let me ask you a question. When all of life comes crashing down around you, when your world falls apart, when confusion sets in like a very, very heavy fog, and when the concerns overwhelm you, where's your confidence? Jesus told a story. He said there's a man who builds his house. He builds it on sand. When the storms of life come, the winds blow, the rains come, it's not built on the rock, washes it away. But then there's the man who builds on the rock. The storms of life are the same. Rains come, winds blow. You know, stuff happens. But when it's on the rock, the house stands. Sometimes it's not until the rain and the wind blows that we determine whether or not our house is built on a rock. Sometimes we think it is, and then when terrible things happen, when bad things happen, when confusion sets in, when all these things happen around us that we don't understand, we have heavy concerns, and our house begins to crumble and shifting inside and washing away. Then we can look around and say, oh my gosh, I forgot to build on the rock. Is your house built on the rock? Is your life built on the rock of salvation? Things don't make sense in God's economy sometimes. The Jews couldn't understand it. The Romans couldn't grasp it. The Greeks, it was not intelligent. But there was an old rugged cross that when everybody looks at it, you can say to God, God, that doesn't make sense. How can you take what happened on that and build my life on a rock, on the person who died on that cross? How can my life find stability and security and strength through that? Because He's everlasting. Because He's ever-present. Because He's God. Because He's the Holy One. Because He's faithful. Because He's the rock. Are you built on the rock? Father, there are people in this place right now, myself included, carrying a burden that makes their heart sag from their chest to their toes. Confusion that has set in like a fog that's as black as night, you can't see. Concerns that are so deep that we feel like we're treading water in the midst of the ocean. Father, I pray for that person who has not the confidence that their life is built upon the rock. And I pray that that person would come to the saving faith of Jesus Christ and know Him and know their life built upon the rock of an unchanging God who loves them and cares for them and will answer them with hope and faithfulness of His own. Father, I pray that as You sovereignly work in the heart of people, someone here today who's not given their life to Christ, who's never built their heart, their house upon the rock, who's not placed that thing, their heart in that stable position, their house has been crumbling around them, and they've lost their footing, and they've realized that they were building upon a religion, or they were building upon a church idea, or they were building upon a philosophy of politics or whatever. I pray that that person, as You sovereignly work in their lives, that they would come to the knowledge of Christ, accept what Jesus did on behalf of them, take their sins, transplant them to the cross, take His righteousness, transplant it to their heart. Father, may we rejoice with them in that as they give testimony of the reality of that which happened in their life. We give You praise and honor, Lord, in Jesus' name. Amen. As our ushers take their position, we're going to take our offering real quickly. As I said before, we have a family who is in need, and we're going to assist them in every way that we possibly can. Church family, it's one of our family members. Again, if you're a guest, we're not asking you to do that. If you choose to, you're more than welcome to. If you didn't come prepared to give today in this way and you'd like to, you're welcome to mail that in or get it to us, and we'll make sure that we take care of that. All right, let's take our offering as we sing our theme song as well. Let's stand together.
Sing to the Lord in the spirit of love. Raise up your voice in His name.